You are listening to Free Radio Olympia. Here at the Thunderbolt, I tend to cover a lot of controversial topics from controversial points of view. And therefore, some of the other folks that work with this radio station always appreciate it when I point out that while they may agree with the views expressed on this program, they also very well may not. And in either case, they are in no way responsible for that content. Therefore, if my show makes you want to start hurling blunt objects at people, then make sure you choose the correct target, which in this case would be me, not them. And now, on with the show! Guess, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day, you turned on your radio, and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids, the thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee! Hunter S. Thompson once said that when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. So considering the world situation, I think it's time for the Thunderbolt to turn pro. Welcome to Bubble World. The central philosophy behind the Thunderbolt's activism is that most people are good people who are guilty of nothing more than believing what they see on the media machine. And that even if a relatively small minority of them figured out what was really going on, then they would rise up in outrage and put a stop to it. So right after World War I, the machine spent spurious money on scientific studies on how to manipulate public perception. And they have been spending serious money ever since, implementing all the best practices that their studies revealed. Now this has resulted in the population of the United States being wrapped firmly within a bubble that has absolutely nothing to do with facts or reality or even sanity. And I call this the Great American Bubble Machine. The Great American Bubble Machine has convinced most Americans that it is honorable to sit in an air-conditioned bunker in Nevada while you mass murder women and children with a drone, but that it is cowardly to voluntarily give your life on a certain death-suicide mission, flying an airplane into a building. The
great American bubble machine has convinced most Americans that making rich people richer is good for everyone. This is in spite of the fact that history has proven over and over and over again that always, invariably, without fail, 100% of the time, making rich people richer not only helps absolutely no one but rich people, but always, invariably, without fail, 100% of the time, proves utterly disastrous, often fatally so, for everyone who is not a rich person. The great American bubble machine has convinced most Americans that it is perfectly acceptable for one man to own a measurable portion of the whole frigging planet, while a mentally ill person is left to live on the street or die in an alley. Until recently, the great American bubble machine had managed to convince most Americans that smoking a harmless medicinal herb was a dangerous enough activity to warrant locking people up for decades over it. Yet at the same time, it was perfectly acceptable to consume a drug that is thoroughly deadly, highly addictive, destroys lives, wrecks families, and is the leading cause of violence in our culture. It is responsible for a mass slaughter on our highways every year, and is directly responsible for tens of thousands of deaths every year. Well, personally, I think we would be much better off if we would start living in a reality-based world. You know, at first I hesitated to do this piece because I didn't want to burst anyone's bubble. You know, propaganda and police are far from the only public manipulations tools available to the one percenters. For many decades, foundations and philanthropic grants have also played a vital role in the one percenters' control and manipulation of public perception.
Where has it gone?
In fact, I maintain that this is one of the most important and the least understood of all the tactics that they use to control us.
You cannot break my ribs are strong. My ribs are strong.
So I have mentioned several times in the past how just after World War I, the one percenters began spending big bucks on scientific studies on how to manipulate public perceptions.
Here we are, scattered on the world. Blessed are the ones who blessed our hands as one. 'Cause here we are, scattered within our wounded selves. Bless this life of ours. take us to ourselves.
Yes, using their money to manipulate the opposition is one of the results of these studies. These studies led to David Rockefeller founding the Council on Foreign Relations.
I would like to say here come, we're here for the coming of the sun. Bless this life of ours, take us to our Savior.
CFR is the premier organization promoting the New World Order. The CFR supports evolution rather than revolution. What this means is that the instant any grassroots organization starts wielding influence, the one percenters try to take over and co-opt it.
Where has it gone?
They form foundations to shower grant money upon them. They try to get their own people into the leadership positions.
You cannot break my ribs are strong.
They also do this with NGOs.
You cannot break my ribs are strong.
They do this so they can promote counter-establishment memes in order to marginalize anti-establishment memes. They promote reform rather than revolution. Thus, during the race riots of the 60s, the foundations very generously funded legalistic and reformist organizations such as the NAACP rather than the more effective but more radical organizations such as the Black Panthers. This way, rather than actually getting to the roots of racism, they could just allow a few blacks to rise within the system and thus make them part of the system rather than being forced to actually change the system. Thus, they neuter revolutionaries rather than allowing them to reproduce. And thus, you see a vile currency manipulator such as George Soros funding all kinds of worthy causes. Not because he cares about the causes, but just so he can control them and restrain them, lest they trot a path too revolutionary. Yes, the Rockefellers, the Fords, and the Carnegies. All of them not only participate in this co-optation of revolutionary and or social justice organizations, but they literally pioneered the field. They seek to professionalize social justice movements because then, as professionals, they gain status as part of the system. Rather than in opposition to the system, they're invited to conferences. They're invited to speak at events. They sometimes appear on the magic media. They are literally brought into the very heart of the very machine they were allegedly fighting. Now keep in mind, these same people fund Democracy Now. They fund Ralph Nader. Eventually, the leaders of these social justice organizations, even the good people who started off to do good things, often become trapped within this institutional meme. There are certain lines they no longer want to cross because that would endanger their new status. In addition, once they become dependent upon funding from a certain source, then the tendency to not bite the hand that is feeding them can become paramount. Now, since the policies of the 1% basically consist of raping the earth and the people who live there, then their policies tend to create massive social upheaval and warfare. Thus, the one percenters need all the public manipulation tools that they can get. Educating their lackeys properly is also another part of this plan. John D. Rockefeller founded the University of Chicago to create consensus amongst societal elites as to beliefs and ideologies, and also to train their upcoming lackeys in their newly pioneered methods of controlling the masses. Cornell and Vanderbilt universities were founded for the same reasons. Yes, these universities first institutionalized the social sciences, in particular, economics, politics, and sociology. They did this so they could subsequently institutionalize all of the intellectuals in order to draw them away from any radical ideologies they may otherwise be exposed to. This way, they could focus public attention upon the symptoms rather than upon the disease itself. Now, this is very important because the one percenters are themselves the disease itself, and thus the one percenters don't want us to actually fix the problem, because that would mean seriously downgrading, if not completely eliminating, their privileged positions. Thus, they promote reform rather than revolution. They support supergluing the existing non-sustainable structure rather than tearing it down and building something better. And this is why all these famous foundations suddenly popped up in the early 20th century, seemingly doing all these wonderful philanthropic works. It was all done for PR and for purposes of manipulation and deflection. Make no mistake, kids. These foundations are the tools of control and domination. And as for the NGOs, you may remember that the Christian missionary system was one of the vital tools of 19th and 20th century imperialism. Well, the NGOs have now taken over that role. They are there to preach the gospel of compassionate capitalism, even though there is no such thing. The individual people who make up those missions and who work for these NGOs are often the very best people with the very best of intentions. They enter the world of NGOs because they want to make change, but they consider politics to be too dirty. But they are actually there merely to mitigate the symptoms, not to cure the disease. One percenters know the true role of these NGOs, even if the employees and volunteers who actually do the work don't. They are there to relieve poverty. They are not there to ask why there is so much poverty. They are there to help refugees during war. They are not there to ask why there is so much war. They are there to report on poverty and injustice. They are not there to ask why there is so much inequality and injustice. They are there to treat the victims. They are not there to question the reason for their victimization. They are not to question the system that creates all this poverty, war, and injustice. And their actions actually strengthen the system, because NGOs often pacify good people into thinking they are making things better, but instead they are acting as enablers. And the fact that the 1% so cynically use so many truly good people to accomplish such incredibly vile ends is one of the many utterly contemptible attributes that the 1% displays. Now, this problem is further exacerbated by the fact that when the 1%ers fund social justice organizations, then they often insist upon line item control of their budgets. They often demand certain results. And since they tend to fund on a quarterly schedule, and since true change often takes generations, then they are not geared for long-term projects or goals. Thus, the social justice organizations spend all of their time on ineffective short-term fixes rather than doing long-range planning for true and effective change. And of course, the 1%ers also use these foundations to manipulate the opinions of the general public. One of the originals, the Rockefeller Foundation, was first formed as a direct result of the Ludlow Massacre, wherein Mr. Rockefeller paid National Guard troops to massacre a bunch of striking miners. And they ended up killing up a large number of their women and children as well. This resulted in a massive scandal. And thus, Mr. Rockefeller hired the very first PR man. His name was Ivy Lee. And Mr. Lee convinced the public that Mr. Rockefeller was actually a swell fellow after all. Suddenly, Mr. Rockefeller was all over the news for all of the charitable contributions he was making. He spent several times as much money advertising his contributions as he did actually contributing, but that fact was not mentioned. And it worked. Very quickly, Mr. Rockefeller was transformed in the public eye from a murderer of women and children into a philanthropic hero. And thus, the model grew. The foundations were soon forming think tanks, such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and the Bilderberger Group. All of these groups were very lavishly funded. The Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Corporation also got together in 1924 and formed the Social Science Research Council. They did this to act as a secret conduit between the foundations and the universities so the public would not know that the foundations were actually the ones who were directing the course and curriculum of the social sciences education in the American universities.
What is that you say? You got a whistle in the wind. Yeah, go down, go down. Go down. Live here for me, and I will live here for you. Live here.
They must go to such extraordinary lengths because they absolutely do not want students to actually understand what is going on.
Blow down. Little shaking the law, daddy long legger. The bigger the dog, the baby with the cat turned blue.
This is why the universities so severely compartmentalize education in the fields of sociology, economics, and politics. And never shall the fields meet. They do this even though all three fields are intimately intertwined. And you cannot truly understand any one without having at least a basic understanding of all three.
Yeah, what is that you say?
They separate these sciences
get, yeah.
Because if students ever started learning about all three, and about how they all interact, then they would very quickly discern what an insane, unfair, and unsustainable scam it all is. These foundations have profoundly influenced every area of our society, from politics to education, to the environmental movement, to psychiatry. They decide what your child will learn in school. They will decide who will be the president of the United States. Their influence is, if anything, even more pervasive in the third world, where their money goes even further. They are ubiquitous, and they are pure frigging evil. We need to marginalize these people, and we can't beat them playing their game by their rules. Especially when they themselves are not subject to the rules. We cannot beat them in their rigged game by playing with their stacked deck. I am convinced, in fact, that what we need to do is to create our own system and then simply make their machine irrelevant. It's time to take a quick station break. We'll be back in a minute. The views expressed on this program are strictly those of the show's producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station nor anyone associated with this radio station. And now, back to the Thunderbolt. Welcome back. You know, I've studied quite a bit of history, and as far as I've been able to determine, Genghis Khan was the only person of color who has ever invaded white people. And I theorize that this is why Genghis Khan never gets the same props or the same laurels as other lesser invaders and empire builders, such as Napoleon, Alexander, and Caesar. Rather than a glorious conqueror and empire builder, Genghis Khan is almost always depicted as a savage, bloodthirsty monster. At one point in American history, the term Mongoloid literally became a racial slur. Genghis Khan has been demonized and diminished in so-called Western culture ever since he first appeared on the scene. Genghis Khan conquered the largest land empire that anyone has ever put together, Romans and British notwithstanding. And unlike all those other empires, Genghis Khan put his thing together in his single lifetime. And the Khanate the Genghis Khan founded lasted in various forms for hundreds of years. Now, Genghis Khan was indeed incredibly savage in battle, and he is mostly known for his habit of wiping out entire populations of entire cities and then burning those cities to the ground
without mercy. If they really pissed him off, he would even salt their soil. Yes, guilty as charged. Genghis Khan not only did indeed do all of those things, but he did all of those things really a lot. However, here is the thing about Genghis Khan. Unlike any other major conqueror of which I am aware, Genghis Khan almost always gave his opponents a choice. If the besieged city in question simply surrendered and acknowledged the Khan as their sovereign, then nothing else in their lives would change very much. The Khan would station a few troops, and he would justly and fairly charge them a few taxes for the very real protection that those troops offered. He would station a few local officials to keep an eye on things, but otherwise, the locals were not only allowed to keep their lives, but with the understanding that the Khan's officials could overrule them if they felt it necessary, the locals could even keep their local officials and local laws and local practices. Or not, as the case may have been. And not only that, but in addition, they could keep their unburned city, they could keep their unsalted land, and they could keep their unraped wives, and they could keep their unmurdered children, and they could keep their jobs.
Joshua fought the battle of Jericho.
And they could keep
Jericho,
their dignity.
Jericho. Hey, Joshua fought the battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down.
And they could even keep their religion.
Gideon, you may talk about your man of swole,
but Genghis Khan,
like good old Joshua,
strictly forbade religious persecution
of
any kind.
Jericho, Jericho.
And another unique attribute was that while he had no problem killing thousands of people at a time, Genghis Khan strictly forbade torture. And another practice, almost unique to Genghis Khan, was that he strictly enforced a zero-tolerance policy on the buying, selling, or kidnapping of women. The Khan's own mother had been a kidnap victim, and the Khan himself had grown up as a slave as a result. Thus, if you kidnapped, bought, or sold any woman on the Khan's turf, then the Khan would cut your freaking head off. This practice succeeded at seriously curbing the practice of slavery in the Khan's empire. Now keep in mind, Genghis Khan was almost unique in all of these attributes, both at that time and in all succeeding times until now. And FYI, the only reason the Khan didn't just keep on going into Western Europe was partly because thickly wooded landscapes were not conducive to his form of warfare. But also, because he considered the Western Europeans of the time to be so poor and so pitiful that the con figured they would prove to be more of a liability than anything else, and he thus did not consider them to be worthy of conquering. Anyway, Genghis Khan came to power because a foreign oppressive Buddhist power structure in Mongolia was trying to force convert the local Uyghur Muslims to Buddhism. Then, after winning that battle, Genghis Khan just kept going from there. Genghis Khan thus literally came to power defending religious freedom, and evidently took that concept to heart. He referred to all religions as the fingers of God, and he militantly enforced religious freedom throughout his entire empire for his entire life. And there is evidence that several of the authors of the American Constitution studied the Khan's empire and were thus aware of the religious freedom aspects of that empire, and thus were also aware of the fruits that the practice of enforced religious freedom could produce, such as peace, for one thing. Because that brings us to the final thing about Genghis Khan's empire that he never gets any props for. For you see, once he conquered,
Joshua fought the battle of Jericho.
The lands that fell Jericho under Genghis Khan's Jericho dominion subsequently
Jericho
experienced true peace for over 100 years. And I believe that historical epic to be the most universal and widespread period of true peace that any large nation has ever experienced since the dawn of civilization. And keep in mind that they maintained peace in an empire that extended from the Pacific Ocean to Eastern Europe and included most of the Middle East.
And the walls came tumbling down.
Oh, what's this? What am I doing?
No wars. No conquerors pillaging and plundering and raping and killing. The Khans strictly forbade all such things, and you messed with the Khans at your own risk.
And the trumpets begin to sound. Oh, Joshua told his children to give a shout, and the walls came a-tumbling down.
In the case of Eastern Europe and the Middle East, regular invasions, burnings, and killings had traditionally been endured by nearly every other generation for millennia, and serious oppression of all common people was pretty much the universal norm nearly everywhere. Yep, peace for over 100 years must have been a very nice break for all those people.
Hey, look, it's Junior!
Hey, Junior! Hi!
So what all this means is that Genghis Khan was a prince of peace. He was a defender of women's rights, and he was the father of religious freedom. Yes, the history books apparently got it right. This dark-skinned barbarian obviously had no understanding of modern civilization. In the early 70s, I spent a few months in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho. Walls came tumbling down. Hallelujah.
Now, this was shortly after the mafia had been run out of town. And while I was there, I heard more than one local complain that without mafia management, the casinos had gone to shite and that the streets were always full of trash. Conditions that the mafia would have never put up with. Yeah, the mafiosi were a bunch of psychopathic murderers, thieves, and malefactors. But at least they ran a high-class game, and at least they kept the streets clean.
Up to the walls of Jericho, with sworn drawn in his hand, go blow them hogs like Joshua, the battle is in my hand. Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho.
If your dictator is benevolent, then sometimes people prefer them, because often they can actually get things done. The thing is that benevolent dictators are a very rare breed. That's it for the news and commentary this week. It's time to get to work. All right. So once again, I have some music to fill in the rest of the hour for everyone. And this week, I'm going to focus on really weird but really good cover songs. This is the Moog Cookbook.
That was a fun band I discovered a couple of years ago called Moog Cookbook, doing Hotel California before that was Born to be Wild. And that's it for the regular part of the show, though I do need to apologize to Chaos and to Rainier Avenue radio listeners, as I uploaded your shows to the Thunderbolt Dropbox folder last week, but then I forgot to send the links to Chaos and Rainier Avenue respectively, and I did not even realize it until I complained to Chaos later about not airing my show last week, and they informed me they never got it. Anyway, that show contained part 7 of our coverage of the Symbiosis Revolution Congress in 2019. And if you would like to hear that show, then you can find it archived at our website, which is dana98501.wordpress.com. And 98501 is the downtown Olympia zip code, if that helps you remember that. The shows are listed in reverse chronological order on the right side of the page, and you need to look for the show called Over the Cliff. Or, if you're numerically orientated, that would be the show labeled TBR220114. Once again, I would like to reiterate that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station nor anyone associated with this radio station. And meanwhile...
Thank you very much.